Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to the A-List with me, Jennifer Lindsay. Every week we chat with an influencer to see what makes them tick. And today, Thursday, September 17th, 2009, I am delighted to welcome co-host of Revision 3's Techzilla, who's also a gamer, gadgeteer, cat lover, many other things, and one of the best-known online video and podcasting names, Veronica Belmont. Welcome, Veronica.
Hi, thank you for having me.
I'm thrilled to have you on. It's been interesting to see the response to having you on. But I want to ask you, just kind of starting out, so as I was going through your bio, I'm, you know, reading all these interesting things, and I'm going, how does a grad from Emerson College end up one of the big names on the media side of gaming and tech media just a few years later?
Your guess is as good as mine. It's been a very interesting road.
Pardon?
It's been a very interesting road, that's for sure.
So, I mean, you started at CNET, and you were kind of on the other side of the camera, and then you were able to make that transition. For folks that, you know, want to be able to do that, that don't do it just, you know, I mean, obviously anybody can pick up a camera and do it now, but want to do it with some authority, with, a name brand or whatever, what would your advice be to them?
You know, it's one of the hardest questions I get all the time, because it really was such a lucky happenstance that everything kind of fell together the way that it did. I never intended to be a video talent, and so when it happened, you know, I kind of learned as I went. I didn't really have any kind of specific goals in mind or any kind of plan that I was following. So it's hard for me to answer that question, you know, because, like I said, I didn't have an intended path that I was following. But I guess it was just about doing what you love. I mean, the way that I got started doing it was I was producing Buzz Out Loud, and I was also editing video for CNET for First Look from the Labs. And I guess my boss kind of noticed that I was really into what I was talking about, and I was really into the products and the stuff that we were discussing on the show. Mm-hmm. And so he gave me an opportunity to host a couple of how-to videos for CNET TV, which had just gotten a reboot at the time. Mm-hmm. And so I gave it a shot. I did a couple of videos, and of course I was a little bit messy and a little bit jerky and didn't really, you know, have that kind of flow that comes with doing it over time. But like I said, it just takes a long time for you to kind of feel comfortable with being yourself in front of the camera. And so it's taken me a few years, but I think I'm finally getting the hang of it.
So that was in what year? What year was your first on-air blip?
Probably, I want to say either 2005 or 2006. I started at CNET in 2004, and I was just doing all post-production work and editing for at least the first year or so. So I would say probably, I think it's on my Wikipedia page. I think it was in the spring of 2006, I want to say, that I did my first
video. You don't
video.
Have to be that specific. We're just having a laugh here. But, I mean, I think that one of the things that people miss is that, you, as you said, that was a reboot for CNET. And, you know, I wonder if you've ever thought about it this way, because obviously I think probably too much about the people that I'm going to be interviewing. But do you think that in any way, I mean, you were kind of an early personal brand, and I think it was, from what I can tell, it was sort of an organic process of becoming Veronica Belmont. Oh, have you heard of Veronica Belmont? Have you seen what Veronica Belmont did? And I feel like in a way maybe you helped drive CNET's visibility, and, you know, I mean, they've gotten to the point where they've been, as we know, acquired by CBS Interactive. And I'm not going to, you know, credit you with that, but I mean, maybe it helped them were there any times where you were doing video for them where they, you know, could tell that maybe you were onto something that they hadn't been onto before? Because you were definitely, I think, at that time, if I remember, a very different kind of talent. You know, they let someone on that was, first of all, female, young, obviously people, you know, all over the place consider you very sexy and all those things. So, I mean, you know, whether you consider yourself those things or not, do you think that, you know, you helped, or was there any point where you think you kind of opened some eyes to what online video and rich media can be online?
What I think I probably did do was encourage them to better use social networking and really, you know, take a look at what was going on in the social networking world around them, you know, particularly with Twitter and even with YouTube. And I think I did kind of push at the time that we embrace those technologies a little bit more within the company. I didn't have a lot of power then at all, you know, not within mm-hmm. the company at all. I was just an associate editor, you know, started as an intern. But I think, you know, the more I pushed it, and Tom and Molly from Buzz Out Loud are also big proponents of using social networking to kind of get things done. And I think it resonated within the company, and now they're using Twitter, and they're using all sorts of different social networking tools all the time. And I think it's helped them grow, for sure.
Yeah, I mean, we see that as, like, essential now, right? I mean, if you don't use social networking, you're probably a big television station that I've worked for before, trying to convince them to be more transparent and explain to people what's happening behind the scenes. So, I mean, you know, this is kind of like a behind-the-scenes look of your career in some way. You know, one of the things that, you know, I've been made aware of this week is that I got the most mail about your appearance on the show than I've ever gotten. And I've had some people that I would consider more polarizing figures, certainly, than you. But it was interesting that I got such a response. And I think, you know, certainly I would say that you have some level of, maybe notoriety is the wrong word, but something like that. And I think maybe some of it comes from what I can tell is people think you've had this sort of quick rise. But do you think of that way? Do you think it's true that you've been lucky to sort of rise quickly, or do you think that that's a misconception? Because, I mean, you certainly work your ass off. I mean, if you look at, if you go to Veronica's projects page, which is linked to from jenniferlindsay.com, you can certainly see that you've had to cobble together a lot of different things. So you kind of had your hands in lots of pots, which you know, clearly helps with that visibility. So what's your thought? You know, do you think it's been luck and quick speed, or do you think it's been more of a challenge than people realize?
It's definitely been a challenge, that's for sure. I think I've had a lot of there's a lot of luck involved with it too, because I was presented with a lot of opportunities that I'm very fortunate to have gotten, like working with Texilla and Revision 3, and also doing my gaming show Core on the PlayStation Network. But you know, I didn't just get those things because I didn't try hard to get them and didn't work very hard with them. And you know, I'm not just a talent that reads off a teleprompter. You know, I write all my own scripts and I do all my own research. And so in that sense, it definitely hasn't been handed to me on a silver platter in any way. It's interesting, notoriety. I don't think I've ever been defined as having notoriety.
Well, I just say that because, you know, when in doing research, there's obviously, you know, as much written about you as there is media coming from you and your co-hosts of the different things that you do, and we'll talk about that in a second. But, you know, I think that it's kind of interesting. I had one person on Friend Feed last night that was kind of like attacking me for having you on the show. And I, you know, of course, was, you know, it's kind of ridiculous. And it was interesting, you know, and this gets to kind of your audience. So I kind of want to go, that's kind of where I'm going with this, is that everything I've received has been really positive, and people have been so excited to hear you on the show. And I get this one person on Friend Feed who is like a troll, so I'm not sure that I really recognize her opinion as the same as the level of the others. But, you know, kind of, you know, again, you know, sort of like, you know, why is she on? And, you know, she made some ad hominem attack type stuff. You know, you leave it alone, obviously, when you realize that a person is off kilter. But, you know, you have this, you know, magnetic, it seems, base of people. And what I wanted to ask you about, I guess, in general, like as a fellow woman who's come up in the industry, who's older than you, that's done some of the same things. So I was in traditional television and I moved to new media a long time ago. and so I've been a decade at doing online video and, you know, all that kind of stuff, back when Mark Cuban owned Broadcast.com, you know, figuring out how to get video on the web that was considered valuable. Do you, for me, I guess, I feel like there's a bit of a strange thing that happens with gender. Do you feel that at all? Or do you feel like you've really been embraced, or do you feel like you get any kind of, because, you know, I think that people sense, you know, that there's this, like, we are family with women, but it can be so catty.
That's interesting. Yeah, it's, the woman thing is definitely something that will affect you from time to time. I mean, there's always going to be fans who are just into it because you're a girl doing technology coverage, and that's to be expected. You know, it goes both ways. But I have a really great base of viewers and readers that are super supportive, and, you know, it's the same kind of response that someone like Leo Laporte gets, or Chris Perillo, or Patrick Morton. It's the same kind of community. And so they respect the work that we do, and respect that, you know, we really care about the subject matter a lot. So, of course, there's always going to be trolls who think that you're just getting the work because you're, you know, a female, and because that's somehow different in the space. But when you think about it, it's really not that different. There's tons of women who are doing the same thing I am, who are doing very similar work, and who have been doing it for a very long time. And so it is kind of disheartening, especially when you get that cattiness from other females. It's like, can't you look above it? Can't you, like, look that we're doing, like, a lot of positive work and you know, trying to make things move forward in the same way that anyone else is?
Yeah, I welcome people to write to me or comment on my blog so that I, you know, have, you know, community-generated questions, obviously, and there's a level of transparency. But when someone can't even tell you why they think a certain thing, give me one example or one anything that wasn't, you know, that you didn't like for a certain reason, nothing comes back. So, you know, there's really not a lot of...
There's going to be people who don't like you for some arbitrary reason. You know, there's talent out there in the industry that I'm not a huge fan of, but, you know, I'm not going to go publicly berate them or anything. It's how they do their job. That's not really my problem. If you don't like it, don't watch it. You know, but
exactly.
I just have to find the stuff that you do like and have a positive influence on it. Don't just tear down people because you don't like how they talk or how they look.
Well, and especially in this day and age where, you know, I don't want to get away from the audience question too far, but we'll get to this part in a second. But the audience. So, you know, you've done sort of the tech, more the general tech shows, and now you've gone kind of deep into gaming, it seems. Well, I guess not, right? Tell me about what's happening right now, where you're at with the collision of sort of gaming and more general technology in the work that you're doing for Core and Revision 3's Texzilla.
They're two similar but very different jobs at the same time. Texzilla is obviously a general technology help and how-to show, and we review products and do interviews with people in the industry. And it's a lot of fun, and I've known Patrick and Roger, my producer, for a very long time, so it's cool to get to work with them, and the community over there is just fantastic. Core, on the other hand, it's a monthly interactive magazine that runs on the PlayStation Network. And so we go to developers and talk to them about the games that they're working on, and it's a lot more interview-based. And it's a little more serious in a way, I guess, which is kind of funny considering it's like gaming. You would think it would be a little more over the top. But because we are a Sony product, I work for Future US, which is a magazine publisher, and we're the ones who create the show for Sony. So I'm not technically a Sony employee, but we have to abide by their standards and kind of work under their conditions, of course, because the show is produced for them. So we have to take it a little more seriously. We get to be goofier on Texzilla, which I appreciate, because it's kind of
my... Is that the one where you're licking the lollipops?
Licking the lollipops.
There's a video on your homepage where it looks like you're... I haven't watched the video, so I don't know if that's what you're doing, but it looks like you're having an ice cream with someone.
Having ice cream. Oh, is that the video that's on my page now?
Yeah.
That's I did a guest spot on Vendor TV, which is Dan Delaney's really excellent food podcast, where he goes around the country and visits food carts, like taco trucks, but way more over the top, like fancy and expensive. So we went to Spencer's To Go, which is a French food truck that patrols around the Soma area. And what you're probably seeing me eating there is escargot on a stick.
Escargot on a stick, hey.
Yeah.
The pros to being an online video star. So what I wanted to ask you about the audience piece was, so obviously, you know, as you've kind of gone into gaming, because I think CNET was more general technology, like you said, you started doing the how-tos. Where did you really feel like you started in the gaming space?
The gaming space thing kind of happened organically, too, because I am a gamer. I play, I have all the consoles, and I play them pretty regularly as much as I can, although I'm more addicted to World of Warcraft, which is kind of a problem. It cuts into my other gaming time. So we were doing gaming coverage at CNET, and I would do, you know, reviews of new consoles as they came out and talk about the new technology. And then when I was at Mahalo Daily, we did a lot of coverage for Joystick and Engadget for the various gaming conventions like GDC and Tokyo Game Show. And how I got involved with Core is that I was writing gaming reviews for actually just one, for PC Gamer, which is a magazine that's actually owned and operated by Future US, who I work for now. And I've been doing that as a contractor gig on and off. And so they knew my work, and they knew that I was really passionate about gaming as well as technology. And so it just seemed like a really good fit.
So do you feel like you have kind of two audiences, or do you feel like they really overlap and are almost kind of the same, you know, the same group that's been watching you since maybe the beginning or whenever they've found you along the way?
It's super interesting because they don't overlap as much as I thought they would. I think that the Texilla viewers are more prone to watch Core, but I don't think that the Core viewers are as prone to watch Texilla. The gaming community is definitely a much more it's a little – I mean, you can definitely be a gamer and not be into consumer electronics. You know, it's kind of a bigger audience in that way. So they really don't know about my work unless they actively go look for it. So it's kind of funny when they think that I'm just, you know, a gaming host, and then they find out about Texilla or they find out about Sword and Laser. It's kind of a pleasant surprise sometimes. And I like seeing it when they're like, oh, she does this thing too. That's cool.
It's so nice when they do Sword overlap. And Laser is your podcast and that you co-host with someone who's also a name. So tell us about that.
Sword and Laser is it's usually a monthly audio podcast that I host with Tom Merritt, who was my co-host at Buzz Out Loud, and he's still with CNET, CBS. And it's a book club and also a podcast, as I mentioned. So we pick either a science fiction or fantasy book every month and read it and discuss it on the show.
And so what is, if people are just hearing about this, they can find out about it at swordandlaser.com, but where are you guys at right now? Are you in the middle of reading a book, or what's the current activity?
Well, we just actually had our first live episode at Dragon Con in Atlanta, and it went really, really well. We had a great audience, and we had author Timothy Zahn on the show, who writes all the Star Wars sequel books.
Oh, cool.
And so he came on and talked about what he was working on currently. And so we just picked a new book, which is Mists of Avalon, and I can't remember the author's name. It's a woman, and it's all about Guinevere's perception of the whole King Arthur story.
Ah.
So it's like a female point of view. So it's something we haven't really done before. We haven't focused on any main female characters on the show before, so I'm really looking forward to that, and I think it's going to be a really good read. I haven't picked it up yet because I got caught up in another series, well, that we read last time. I just kept reading the series instead of starting the new book, so I have a little bit of catching up to do.
So I think we have, her name is Marion Zimmer Bradley.
Yes, thank you.
For those that want to check out Mists of Avalon, don't want to, you know, it discourage anyone from checking it out, and definitely check out the podcast because it's an interesting world that you kind of go into, and you certainly have a fantastic co-host too.
Yeah.
I think you guys have great chemistry, so it works, you know, really well in terms of
total. He's a total wealth of information. He absorbs so much data in his brain. It's amazing to get him talking about books in particular because he can just go off for a really long time.
Do you have to bring him back?
No, he's good. It's good. It gives me a chance to – he picks up on stuff that I don't, and vice versa, of course. I think we, like you said, we play off each other pretty well. But he is just an encyclopedia of knowledge. It's really amazing.
So when you – go to an electronics store? Like if you were to go to, how do you make your purchases? Are you an online purchaser, or do you, I mean, obviously with gaming, there's a lot of pre-ordering involved usually. And then sometimes if you're, you know, obviously in the space, a lot of things come to you. But if you were going to make a purchase yourself, tell me how you make your purchases.
Oh man. I'm curious. I'm a major online shopper. I am an Amazon addict. I pretty much buy everything online. I don't really remember the last time I went to an actual electronics store, but it is always fun to be able to get some hands-on time with the product before you actually buy it. I'm fortunate that with Texilla, we do get a lot of products in for review, so I get that opportunity to kind of play with them a little bit before I decide if I want to buy them or not. It is kind of fun to go to Best Buy or Fry's or something and just poke around a little bit and see stuff that you may not have picked up on online.
Okay. Are you a PC or Mac user?
I use both. Primarily, my day-to-day machine is a MacBook Pro, but I do use a gaming PC for all my gaming purposes on for PC games, not consoles. Uh-huh. I have an HP Mini 1000 that's running Jolly Cloud, which is a Linux distro that's for netbooks. I'm pretty spread out in terms of operating systems. But if I had to pick one, I would probably stick with the Mac.
Yeah, I got to say, that's been a huge problem with some of the games that are actually for flight training. So there are these great games that are actually that teach you about I'm sure you probably know this, but do flight simulation that are so awesome. And my PC here is a little Vaio, love it, but it's just got this tiny screen, and I have my Mac with its big 17-inch screen, and I just, you know, I look at it, and we're not really monitor people, so we don't really have a lot of monitors around the house, so I'm like, I'm going to have to get a monitor to make that whole thing work, I think, better for me. But got to ask you, favorite product of all time?
Favorite product of all time?
Oh, of man. All time.
Let's see. It would be, it's so trite to say, but it's probably my iPhone. I mean, I really can't go anywhere without it. It's like an attachment. I don't even carry it in my purse. I just hold it in my hand when I walk around places like a weirdo. If I had to pick another device, though, that wasn't so obvious, it would be my Kindle, because I read so much for the book club, and I travel pretty extensively. It's nice to be able to have all my books in one place. I have the Kindle, too, and I just love it.
Yeah, I was so impressed when I actually touched a Kindle, because I do a lot of online shopping, too, and I was somewhere, and probably in an airport, and somebody had one, and I was wanting to, like, touch it and feel it and go, how heavy is it? And, you know, has it gotten lighter from year to year?
It's so funny. I get a lot of comments about it in airports. Whenever I'm on an airplane, I can pretty much count on the person sitting next to me asking me a few questions about it. And I'm always happy to answer, you know, because I want to spread the good word, because I think it's a great product, and I think it encourages people to read more.
What do you think is I think that's a really good point, actually, that people don't necessarily think about too much is, you know, what does encourage people to read, which is, mm-hmm. you know, awesome about the Kindle. But when I think about the Kindle, I also think about sort of the discussion that's happening around tablets right now. You know, what are your general thoughts on tablets and the trend we see for more people using them?
You know, tablets just aren't really something that pique my interest that much. I think it's cool technology, and I think it definitely has a place in a lot of industries, you know, primarily, I would say, for artists or people who have to carry around a laptop with them wherever they go, like maybe a doctor or someone in a hospital or someone on a construction site that needs to keep up to date on everything going on at the time. But, you know, for regular workplace kind of environments, I don't really see the benefit. I don't know if I've talked about it really enough to kind of think it through and flesh out where it would be most beneficial for people. But, yeah, the technology is cool. Doesn't really have a place in my workflow.
Yeah, I think it's an interesting, And for me, it was really interesting because I was thinking about, so one of the big things for me is, you know, all the notes that I take. And, you know, there's the notebooks out there that are like regular notebooks but have the pens that retain the memory of what you've written, you know, based on the codes.
Yeah.
So Scribefire, I think, is what they're called, and or the main company anyway that produces them. I'm sure there are a few, so I don't mean to single them out. But I started thinking, well, should I be thinking about a unit that can like do something? Because it still feels weird to kind of continue to be writing on paper in a way when you end up putting it, you know, in an online form somehow. So I went to like a routine doctor's visit, and they were using a tablet, and I was really impressed with the efficiency suddenly that they had. Like, the front desk already knew what the story mm-hmm. was and what I needed to do to get out of there. So it made my trip to the doctor a lot quicker, which obviously is a nice thing. So, I mean, it's kind of nice to see products come around that do have kind of different uses, but I mean, they can have, I guess, a broad use too. The reason I asked too is, you know, I was wondering if there are any, you know, you've hosted some conferences or emceed at events, certainly, and I've heard stories but have yet to see personally a large contingent of sort of C-level folks come in with, everyone using a tablet. And I've heard that from several different companies, the different events, they'll see, you know, a bunch of executives coming in and they've all got their tablet. So that got me thinking of sort of the other uses that a tablet might have.
Yeah, that's interesting. I haven't really seen that at conferences, but maybe I'm just not looking hard enough for
them.
Yeah,
maybe it's not the conferences we go to that you're going to where they're popular. Who knows? So along the line of favorite product, and I think you're definitely not alone in the iPhone category. I think mobile is, you know, a trend that we'll, you know, see grow and continue so we catch up with other countries in the Western world and even in the, in emerging markets. But your favorite trend?
Favorite trend. Interesting. I like the trend of these like WebOS style operating systems for phones, like the Palm Pre. I think it's really great to be able to connect to all your different services online from your mobile device with relative ease. I think that's really important going forward because so much of our life is online now that it's nice to be able to have a terminal of sorts to that world when you're on the go without having to lug around the laptop and having to look for a Wi-Fi connection. You know, 3G speeds are really important for that kind of data flow. And as long as you can get them in San Francisco, we've been having some issues with our 3G on AT&T. but in other markets, it's working out just fine. And, you know, with the proliferation of Wi-Fi, you know, spreading across the country and becoming more accessible, I think it's going to be increasingly important that we can access all that data and, you know, manipulate it and use it and not just view it.
How much do you cover storage? You know, obviously that's a really related question. You know, all this data is stored somewhere.
Yeah. Hmm? I mean, well, do you mean like cloud kind of storage, or do you mean like
cloud? It can be cloud storage, or you know, even you know, I mean, everybody that it seems like the big players in the storage industry always point out that well, it still has to be housed in a computer somewhere. So,
right.
Or so they don't really, you know, a lot of them don't even, you know, they'll tell you outright that they, you know, maybe it's happened to you that they don't care because they still get the market share, or they're still fighting for the market share. But certainly from a consumer point of view, obviously, you know, there's lots of options for storage. And, you know, I find myself kind of at a crossroads even, and I guess that's prompting the question in some way, is, you know, as we do more things remotely, you've got services like Mosey and others that allow you to store so much online, but yet I have all these external hard drives. So do you see a trend there with storage, or is that something that, you know, you think is kind of still growing or emerging?
I think it's always important to have redundancies in your storage. So if you want to use an online data storage thing like Mozy, for example, it's good to do that. That's fine because, you know, God forbid something happened to your house and all your external drives are destroyed. You still want to have that backup somewhere. But at the same time,
oh my God, don't say that. You just made me paranoid.
I live in San Francisco. We have to think about these things.
Yeah, I know.
Don't know when the big one's coming.
I'm not
so
far from you, but you know.
Yeah. But
I lose my Seagate one terabyte. Oh, my God.
My precious 1 terabyte. Storage is so cheap now. It's becoming so accessible to buy, like, a 1 terabyte drive, for example, or, you know, spend $150 on a 500 gigabyte drive, that it makes sense to also have those physical backups at home that you can, you know, access at will. So I think it's good to have both. It's really wonderful that you're able to get all that data from an online cloud storage, distributed storage site. But I think it's also important to have hard copies or digital copies home as well.
So in terms of your backup process, so each of your computers, are you backing them up, or is there one that you, like, since your Mac is your primary? Because, I mean, that's something that I think people that as they're, you know, as everything starts to, you know, expand, I guess, in our world. So, I mean, we use our gaming units as media servers also, and I think that's something that people miss. So that's, like, a frustrating thing for my husband and I because, you know, like, I'll buy him the new, you know, whatever, or pre-order it or whatever, or buy some accessory that I find online or whatever, and he's like, oh, this is cool, you know, because I'll be an early adopter of some things, and he's an early adopter of other things, and so we kind of bounce off each other. But I remember my brother came to visit recently, and he wanted to use a computer, and we have, you know, a couple laptops that he could, you know, have in the bedroom that he was using and just use. But he went and used my husband's computer, which is like the media, it's got the media server connected to it. It's got, like, you know, a zillion external hard drives. Like a lot of the backup and stuff that we do kind of centralizes in that room. So we basically told him, don't ever touch this machine. And we're like, you know, should we lock the door? You know, I mean, it's like that kind of crazy about, you know, all these media files. And, you know, so it gets me thinking, like, you know, so I, you know, my husband thinks I'm insane because I back up so much. I don't think you can ever over back up. But with, like, your other, you know, some of the other smaller devices, for example, are you backing them up in the same way? Do you treat them the same as you do kind of your base unit?
Well, it's funny. Yeah, I use Time Machine for my MacBook Pro, and I back that up every day. I'm still not totally secure in the Time Machine process. I've seen it not work so well for some people, so I think I'm going to actually do something else as well, like use Carbon Copy Cloner and back everything up and make a bootable disk image of my computer at some point. I just haven't gotten around to it, which is a bad excuse.
Well, that's so funny that you said that, because that was the first thing when I got my big drive. Which wasn't even that recently, but it brings me back. My husband was like, what's the first thing you're going to put on it? And so I said, well, I'm going to do a disk image of my computer. Hello. And he's a total PC user, you know, kind of hardcore silly. Though I think I've brought him over to the Mac side quite a bit, but yeah, I mean, that's awesome. Yeah. So
yeah,
Carbon
for my gaming PC, say that 5 times fast. Carbon Copy Cloner is a really great free program that works wonders. For the gaming PC, I don't really back it up because most of my games I download over Steam or I've got the discs for. So if anything happened to it, I could re-download them without too much trouble. I'd just have to reinstall Steam and then go through the process of downloading them, which would be time-consuming rather, but not too annoying. And for the netbook, since I mentioned I'm using JolyCloud, it's all in the cloud anyway, so I don't really have anything saved to that actual machine. So if anything happened to it, I would just reinstall the operating system and, you know, it would be the same as before.
Yeah, exactly. So in terms of, you know, the product and trend questions I just asked you, I'm going to ask you the opposite. Least favorite product. And if it's a failure, you can tell me the name. You don't have to tell me the name if you don't want to, if it still exists. Or maybe tell, you know, if it didn't ring true with you or something, sort of like tablets, doesn't at the moment have a place in your life.
Gosh, I feel like there's something that I must have been really annoyed at, but nothing's coming to mind off the top of my head right now. I'm sure my viewers would probably be able to come up with a better answer for something that I've hated all
the time.
Even
an operating system? Nothing?
No, just, you know, Windows Vista was kind of terrible, but I didn't really actively use it all that much. I had XP on my gaming machine, and then, actually, I still have XP on my gaming machine, and then I'll probably, you know, I'm going to install Windows 7 on it when the time comes that I get around to it.
Mm-hmm.
So I didn't really have too much of a hard time with Vista. I mean, it was annoying, I guess, but nothing, I didn't hate on it that bad. You know what, I really didn't like the Mighty Mouse, the original Mighty Mouse.
Oh, yeah, they didn't have the right click. Yeah,
oh,
the right,
throw me
no right click and no wireless capacity when at that point there were so many wireless mice.
Yeah, I am talking about the wired one, not the wireless one, although I'm pretty sure I wouldn't enjoy the wireless one either. Just something about the buttons. I like to have really tactile buttons, and so I use a Logitech gaming mouse for all my mousing needs when I'm at home because I have a KVM switcher.
Which is probably more ergonomic, I think, too.
It's super comfortable, and I'm left-handed, but I mouse right-handed, but it fits really well into my hand, and it's got all the buttons I need for my macros for gaming and everything.
Cool. So what about favorite trends, or least
favorite trends,
I should say?
Least favorite trends. I don't think I have a least favorite trend. Yeah, nothing's really coming to mind.
So, I mean, I can think of a few based on, like, for example, the dot bust that just happened. There were a few companies that went out of business that I think were really great ideas that just didn't come to fruition because either they were too early or something like that. Do you have an example like that where something was just too early and like Rock Band, for example, is the great story of, you know, coming back from, you know, Harmonix. You know, I think they even went into Chapter 11 at one point, but then, you know, came around and, you know, have been highly successful, and Beatles Rock Band came out last week.
Mm-hmm.
Anything like that where you could see it, as an early adopter, maybe you'd use it, but it went away because the market share was just too tiny?
Oh, interesting. Let's think. You know, I felt really bad for the Roku boxes, you know, for the Roku Netflix boxes at the time, because that was a great idea, but then Xbox came out with all their Netflix stuff, and that kind of blew them out of the water. No one needed to buy a separate device anymore, so that made me a little bit sad. I think one product that doesn't get enough love is the Zune. Like, the Zune HD is such a beautiful device, and I've really enjoyed using Zunes in the past. The downside, of course, is that they don't have any Mac software. And I think if they tried harder to develop, have their DRM compatible with Mac machines, you know, Apple did it the other way. They made their DRM compatible on Windows boxes.
Mm-hmm,
so it seems that they would really open up a whole new world to themselves if they let the Zunes play nicely with Macs. I'm pretty sure there's some workarounds, but, you know, if you want mass market adoption, you shouldn't have to deal with workarounds.
Yeah, the story today is that they don't have an app store for the Zune HD, so that's obviously a huge hiccup for a lot of people.
Yeah, they're working on Twitter and Facebook integration, I read, which is nice, and that'll definitely help, but they need some kind of app store, and they need to get the gaming stuff off the ground and really make it a viable competitor with the iPod and iPhone.
Yeah,
I mean,
absolutely.
It's not a phone, of course, but people are using their iPhone as their media device and gaming device now, too.
So
they need to step up their game a little bit. The hardware is there, but they need to work on the software.
So do you do gaming on the road? And if so, what device do you use?
I have just started really getting into gaming on my iPhone. I didn't like it at first. I wasn't happy with the controls, but developers have really stepped up their game in a way and made some really innovative products that are a lot of fun. I've been playing Oregon Trail lately, which was one of my favorite games growing up, and Civ Revolutions, and, you know, Scrabble. When you connect it to Facebook, it's really fun because you can play on both platforms. And so I think they're really doing a lot of amazing things on the iPhone lately. Otherwise, I have a DS and, PSP, but I don't play them as much as I used to. I pretty much just read when I'm traveling as opposed to gaming.
Right. So one of the questions I have for you is what's your favorite, if you can say, gaming unit at home?
I mean, they kind of serve different functions.
But, I mean, it's kind of a loaded question, and I don't, you know, I'm not sure with your affiliations if you can really answer it. But I guess maybe I'll ask you a different way. So what gaming unit, if any, do you find you're using for different purposes than just gaming that maybe you're using more broadly for other?
You know, I can probably pretty much answer this honestly. I use my gaming PC more than any other console. Just because it's a PC, so I can do all my internet work on it as well. And also, I'm an MMO player, and so the consoles haven't really caught up to that yet in
right.
a way that is workable for me. So I'm pretty much on the gaming PC more than any other console. I use the Xbox and the PS3 for watching movies and downloading media and content. And, you know, the Blu-ray player on the PS3 is a perfect example of that. It's really great to have that and integrate it into a gaming box as well. So, yeah, I use all of them. I probably use the gaming PC the most. Hope I don't
There you go. An honest answer. Never happens. So biggest challenge on the road that you've, you know, traveled. You know, you've certainly, you know, you strike me with, you know, as I said before, as someone who's kind of organically grown a name for themselves. I remember the times when I started hearing your name. So I feel like, but in talking with you, and you've always seemed so down to earth, it doesn't feel like it's been really something that you've had to work to, you know what I mean? How people today are sort of like, oh, my personal brand is this, and they use
yeah,
it for everything.
Yeah.
I probably am guilty of that too, to some extent, but really more just because it's the easiest way, especially if you do speaking and events and stuff, for people to figure out how to find you. But do you feel like, you know, I mean, how do you feel about that? Do you feel like it was kind of organic, or and how do you feel about this whole idea that, you know, people are sort of, you know, out there purposefully branding themselves front and center?
It's with me, it's kind of what you see is what you get. I've been so involved with the internet community for so long that it's really hard for me to be anything else but who I am online. You know what I mean? That's why it's really hurtful when people say, like, really offhand comments about, like, oh, she doesn't really care about this stuff, blah, blah, blah. I take it a lot more personally because I'm so involved with the community, and I really interact with it because that's what I do for fun. It's not like I just do it to go out and brand myself. It's like, what else would I be doing? I sit on the computer all day and talk to people on FriendFeed and talk to people on Twitter and, you know, go on Facebook and you know, manage stuff there and go into the Revision 3 forums and talk to people there. It's just what I would do for fun anyway, you know, and what I've been doing for, you know, the past decade or more. So it really kind of sucks when people say stuff like that because you're like, obviously you don't know anything about me if you're making offhand judgments like that. But, you know, branding is important, and people who want to get into the industry have to, you know, they have to do it somehow. And it's important to just be yourself at the end of the day, because if you put forward one kind of persona online and then people meet you at a conference and you're really not that way in person, it's going to be kind of off-putting and weird. And I don't really see what the benefit is to cultivating a personality that isn't really your own. I don't really know how many people do that, but I think people kind of put an exaggerated version of themselves online from time to time. And that's good for getting attention, but it's not really sustainable.
Yeah, I feel like there's sort of, you know, certainly it's generational too. And, you know, I don't know if you ever think about the sort of, you know, obviously in the TV world, we're like trained to look at behavioral specifics, which, you know, leads me to my love of analytics and being really geeky about metrics and how it can prove a lot of things. You know, like I have this, you know, sustained belief that we could prove ROI in the social media space if people would just learn how to analyze analytics properly, mm-hmm. or if they were installed properly more across the board, which is a little mm-hmm. bit outside of this realm. But it definitely makes me think, you know, in terms of your age and where you sit, you know, arguably you're a millennial or you're Gen Y. Gen X, I definitely, you know, so I see these trends of like, okay, boomers are completely out of the picture when it comes to most people, you know, being into personal branding. Generation X is all about the personal branding. You know, it's that typical Time magazine cover story of everybody kind of being their own person, all dressed in black and not looking at each other and every man for himself kind of thing. And then Gen Y, where, you know, the Time magazine cover story there was everybody in a dorm room kind of piled on each other where their friends or their life. And you seem to me to kind of fall between the two in a sense. And I wonder, you know, as I'm kind of analyzing you, if you're analyzing your audience too and have a sense of kind of age groups that you touch.
Mm-hmm. It does seem to skew a little bit younger for me. It seems like primarily I would say my audience is anywhere between, I really can't make the generalization because I think it's different depending on where I'm engaging. Techzilla seems to be a pretty wide range of people. I mean, we get emails and video messages from people, you know, well into their, you know, 40s and 50s easily, all the time, and they're good questions, and they obviously know what they're talking about and are involved in that kind of community. With the gaming stuff, it tends to skew a little bit lower, I would say, probably, you know, 25 and under.
Mm-hmm.
And then online, it's just a huge melting pot of different people. So I don't really know. It's definitely people that have, I see a lot of people who have just grown up with it, you know, who just don't really know any other way of doing things other than being online and having that, you know, public profile out there and into the world. And it's a little bit scary sometimes, especially when you see people on Facebook who they take to it like ducks to water, but at the same time they don't have that kind of understanding that everything they put online is public and can affect their, you know, public life, you know.
I mean one of the companies that I'm working with right now is, you know, from a strategy perspective and with some tactical elements too, you know, it's you know, even with my mom, who's a social worker, she mentors people, and she was mentoring a young lady who has lots of different kids, and one of them had her quinceañera. So when she, you know, and so that was all on her Facebook page, and she was updating her status as my mom was talking to me on her mobile, and she was saying, oh, you know, this coworker is doing something on her mobile. And I said, well, what's she doing? She said, oh, she's, I don't know. And she asked her, and I could hear her say that she was talking about where they were going to do some work. They were going to a specific area for a specific home evaluation of a family or whatever. And I was like, oh, my God. And now I'm working with a company where that experience actually comes to bear, and we're, like, actually trying to create guidelines to help people learn to protect themselves mm-hmm. from putting that information out there, which is unrelated, but related in a way.
I feel like my generation is really one of the last generations to have that perspective, that understanding that if you put something online, it's very easy to find, and it can affect like your job, and it can affect what people think of you in your real life,
and it lives forever,
and it can't be deleted. It lives in Google Cache, and people can find it on the, you know, Wayback Machine, and so I try to caution people very strongly, especially teenagers. It's funny to think that there's a teenager out there that will someday be running for president that is putting up like horrifying pictures of themselves with their friends on Facebook.
Yeah.
You know?
Like, I mean, I think we've all learned the Michael Phelps story, hopefully.
Right.
You know, and
so a little caution.
Yeah,
a little
absolutely.
Caution, a
lot of caution, possibly.
Yeah.
So, social networks. I got to ask you, I know you've got over 1 million Twitter followers. For those that don't already know, it's twitter.com/Veronica. But, you know, in terms of Second Life, you know, and the promise that it holds, I think people think that it has, the people that I talk to about it seem to think that it has this great appeal among gamers. Yet, I don't think, I haven't looked at the age groups in a while that it's sort of, you know, popular in, but I don't think the demo really fits that assumption. So I just want to ask you, what's your experience, if any, with Second Life? Do you use it?
I don't use it actively. I have an account that I probably haven't touched in 2 or 3 years at this point. Once in a while, I get a group invitation from within Second Life, and I'm like, how did they even find that name? Like,
yeah, I know, me too.
I don't know how they did that. It just wasn't that fun for me. I really thought it would be. I thought it would be something that I would use quite a bit. But there's something about the interface and something about how clunky it was at the time that just didn't really jive with me. I guess I was used to a lot more of a fluid experience in MMOs. And so to go into this virtual world that was a lot harder to control from my perspective and a lot harder to navigate, it just wasn't as appealing. I just don't know how many people are still really using it. It seems to have broken off into some very specific, cultures.
Mm-hmm.
I don't really know how to describe it. Like, it seems like certain fringe groups have been using it very actively. But I have to say, I'm not really that well versed on where it stands these days and how many people are using it and what's going on. It became very quickly irrelevant to me in a way, which is too bad because I thought the technology was really promising. Maybe that was one of those things that was a little too ahead of its time.
Yeah, and I wonder if, you know, Susan Tenby is over at TechSoup Global has an amazing story about how she got involved in Second Life. And it actually has this really active, so she's a cancer survivor, and she got involved in a cancer survivor network that happened to be on Second Life, and so she, you know, she's kind of a tech girl too, or whatever we are, and so she, you know, went over to Second Life and started learning about all these groups that were, you know, nonprofits in some way. So there are storefronts that actually are near each other, helping each other, and TechSoup is doing a great job of, like, connecting the dots between organizations. So there was this homeless organization that was trying to get people more stability so they could actually apply for jobs and things, and mm-hmm. turned out that the storefront next door was a Cisco-funded project that gives free phone numbers to people in need that are, like, the specific category that this one organization was targeting. So they were able to connect the dots and get them in touch, and so now they partner to provide telephone numbers to the homeless in many parts of the country so that they can apply for jobs and have a steady phone number. And, you know, it's kind of amazing when you think about that being part of Second Life, because that's not at all what I think the people that designed it thought it would actually be used for.
Yeah, there's a lot of support groups on there. I did notice that when I was playing with it a few years ago. There were, like,
yeah.
depression support groups and abuse survivor support groups. And I thought that was a really great element to it, because if you can't meet in person, it's a good way to kind of get together and be able to have, like, a very interactive kind of multimedia experience chat room, really.
Yeah.
So that's
I mean, it would have been great for kids in a lot of ways, too, who, you know, maybe should be protecting their identities had it taken off a little bit earlier than it. But, you know, who knows? I guess at this
yeah.
point it is where it is, and we'll see if there's ever kind of a comeback kid story for it. In the meantime, where do you spend your social networking time? What do you think? So I guess from like so there's the two elements. There's like the useful perspective and the more playful perspective and then like the all-rounder, right?
Yeah. Let's see. I probably spend most of my time on Twitter, I would have to say. I try to respond to people's, you know, questions and comments on Twitter directly. I've been spending a lot of time on FriendFeed. We have a really great, fun group of people on FriendFeed that just, we're silly. We're pretty silly, but it's a lot of fun. We have these epic threads that just go on and on for like 200 comments, and they're all laden with total inside jokes and random acts of silliness. And so I get a big kick out of that, and it definitely helps make a slow work day go by faster. Otherwise, I try to manage my Facebook page as much as possible. I have a fan page on there that's pretty active, and I like to post news articles and stories to that page and then, you know, kind of go through a discussion with the members there. I've been trying to separate my personal Facebook page with my fan page. It's been quite a process because initially I just added everyone to my personal Facebook page, and it became a little bit overwhelming and actually broke Facebook for me. I couldn't use it anymore because it was taking so long to populate these various lists that were being automated that it would just network timeout on me. And so I had to kindly ask some people to, you know, switch over to the fan page instead. I would never force anyone to, but, you know, it's made things a little bit easier now that some more people have moved over. It's such a weird, like, social dynamic, isn't it, to have to ask people to move to, like, a fan page?
Is.
I felt really weird and crappy about it. But at the same time, I couldn't use my Facebook at the time.
I think if you're interfacing with your Facebook page, though, a lot of people don't, or they have a very it feels very forced there. But if it, you know, yours feels very organic, so I don't think that, you know, I think it's a good example of separating well. And of course, there's last night I was just going through my privacy features again, and it never ceases to amaze me the stuff that I, you know, need to or have given, you know, either given permission to or that, you know. I mean, I try to keep things pretty open because, you know, I'm not going to, like, hide my friend lists or whatever from people. So, I make my search public and, you know, you can pretty much see everything because, you know, I want them to know it's the right me if they're looking for me. But, you know, especially because I guess the paranoia of having just got married and in the last year and feeling like, you know, with the additional name at the end, like, you know, maybe I'm missing some of my friends that from, you know, high school that are just now getting on. I'm like, God, where have you been? You know, so that kind of thing. So I just, I kind of keep it open just so people can look at the pictures and go, oh, that is her, you know, and that sort of thing. But at the same time, you know, you think about, oh, God, do I really want people to know the zip code I live in? Like, what can they really find? And I'm a big lover. I love geotechnology. And I was going to ask you about that as our sort of final thing is, you know, obviously you are a name brand. And geotechnology like, you know, Doppler or Brightkite, certainly the iPhone, even Google Latitude can give people access to your location. And sometimes your shoots do too. You probably, you know, promote upcoming shoots that, you know, are pretty specific in location where people could come. Do you, have you ever had a run-in with someone that's either kind of cyber-stalked you or that has, you know, showed up somewhere uninvited and, you know, kind of invaded your
workplace? No, you know, I've been very, very fortunate, knock on wood, that I haven't really had that kind of situation. I try to keep all my geo-specific stuff, you know, among personal friends and people that I do know personally in real life so that it doesn't get out of control. Yeah, I try to keep that stuff a little more under wraps. But in terms of like a creepy kind of situation, I haven't really had too much trouble with it. There's been a couple over the years, you know, that have been a little bit upsetting. But it's always worked out in the end or, you know, for whatever reason it stopped. So I don't know. I do my best to protect myself. And I do my best to kind of keep my location, you know, hidden unless I'm doing a public event. And then of course I'll promote it, but I've been very fortunate, and I hope it continues that way because I know not everyone is that lucky. It can be a very uncomfortable thing when you're presented with someone that is in your personal space that you didn't invite there. So you just have to kind of take the steps to keep yourself safe.
Yeah. It can,
a lot of it's common sense, you know?
Yeah, and sometimes your greatest danger. I mean, I've worked with people where the greatest danger has been people I work with. You know, them being on television doesn't stop sometimes people from being or doing things that are not the most prudent for them. So that's happened to me before and one of my friends. So anyway, you know, I guess lessons you learn along the way. But
yeah.
Thank you, Veronica, for spending time. I feel like there's a million questions I didn't get to ask you, like, do your parents get what you do, or do you feel like people get what you do? But you'll have to leave that. We'll have to leave that for another time. I really appreciate you being on, and I'll let you go on to get on with the rest of your day. Thank you so much for spending the time.
Thank you for having me on.
All right. Thanks again to Veronica Belmont for being our guest today on the A-List, and thank you for tuning in with me, Jennifer Lindsay. Remember to friend us or add us to your favorites here on Blog Talk Radio, and be sure to tune in tomorrow when I interview ComScore Chairman Gian Fulgoni, or Fulgioni, I'm not sure. We'll ask him about that. That's tomorrow at 12 p.m. Pacific. As always, you can keep up with the latest on this show, archives, and free informational webcasts at jenniferlindsay.com. Have a great weekend, everyone.